In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
We gather authors who write for families and young readers, and we celebrate the stories that would otherwise go untold. From SDPB, this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, In the Moment helps kick off the South Dakota Festival of Books. Meet us in Spearfish this weekend, but first we are here in SDPB's Black Hills offices. We've got a studio audience and a great lineup of authors for today's show. Kyla Zhao explores the world of competitive chess in her book, May the Best Player Win. Brittany Richmond introduces us to South Dakota's first licensed female pilot, the ever-dynamic Nellie Zabel Wilhite. And Nancy Beau Flood sends us off with the poetry of the legendary Badger Clark. We are broadcasting today from the SDPB studios in Rapid City. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We are broadcasting today from the South Dakota Community Foundation Gallery. That's inside SDPB's Black Hills Studios in Rapid City. We're joined today by a studio audience for an hour of conversation with authors who have written books for children and families. All of these authors are here for the South Dakota Festival of Books. We will learn about South Dakota's original and perhaps most enduring poet laureate later in the hour. But first, let's meet author Kyla Zhao. Now, a good book for middle grade opens doors that readers might not have known existed. Readers see themselves in the pages of books, and they learn how to see each other. The stakes of their lives are taken seriously, whether it's a fight with a friend, anxiety over a test or a big game, or even the simple desire to make your parents proud while figuring out what makes you happy at the same time. But a great book for middle grade readers does all of this for the target audience, and it also helps adults reading the book connect with their younger selves in ways that help them have more empathy for young people and maybe even reinvigorate their own lives. That's what I was thinking when I was reading May the Best Player Win. Kyla Zhao's book introduces chess player Mei Li, singled out for a trophy at the state chess tournament. Her performance generates buzz and media attention, but one of her teammates distanced himself from Mei because he feels the attention is superficial. Mei, after all, is a girl, and girls, he figures, can't really be better than boys at chess. And that kicks off a series of conflicts and matches that find Mei questioning not only her abilities as a chess player, but her love of the game itself. Kyla Zhao, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This was such a beautiful book, and it relates to being a radio host and being a doctor and being in any kind of profession where sometimes the stress and pressure can help you lose your way. And you say in the book that this was in part an apology to your younger self, because you used to play competitively and you stopped. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I did say that. So I grew up playing chess and I competed all throughout elementary and middle school. But at some point I began to realize that I was being judged for my gender, that there were people out there who perceived that girls couldn't be as good at chess as boys could. And because of that, I felt a very acute sense of not belonging. I felt like I didn't deserve to be in those spaces. I didn't deserve to be playing competitions. If I ever got a good result, I felt very strong imposter syndrome, like, oh, maybe I got lucky. And that's not something that my male teammates would think. If they won, they would think, oh, I'm good enough. Like, I got this on my own merit. But I would just think that I got lucky. And because I felt this very desperate need to prove myself, to prove that I was good enough, to prove that I deserve to be there, I started focusing so much on results. If I didn't walk away from a competition with a trophy or a medal, I felt like I had failed. I felt like I was letting down my parents, my coaches, myself. And as my focus on winning and getting tangible achievements, it began to overshadow my love for the game. And it got to a point when playing chess brought me more frustration and more loneliness than it brought me joy. And so after middle school, I actually quit chess. I took a step back from competitive chess because it just wasn't very healthy for me anymore. And it was only many years later when I was writing this book that I started thinking about the good times I had playing chess, all the good memories. And I began to ask myself, you know, why did I stop? Why didn't I continue? And so this story is a way for me to explore the answers to those questions.
What happened during the pandemic for you regarding chess?
Yeah, so during the pandemic, I was in my third year at Stanford University. Chess was really beginning to take off. You know, with the Queen's Gambit, online chess became really popular, chess streaming. And I saw that my college friends, they were all starting to pick up chess, and they had so much fun playing it. Like, they were awful at it because they were just starting out, but they loved it so much. And it reminded me of a time when I was terrible at chess, and I didn't mind because I just loved the game. I love being able to get better at something, figuring out what I did wrong and what I could do better. And that was a mindset that I haven't felt in a very long time. It was a mindset that I lost towards the end of my chess career. And so writing a story was a way for me to go down that memory lane and ask myself, you know, at what point did it all go wrong? Was there something I could have done differently back then? If I were in my main character's shoes at her age, what would I have done differently?
Yeah, there's so much food.
There is so much food.
So much food.
It was written during the pandemic. Okay. We were all at home. We could not go out to restaurants. I was eating microwavable meals and writing about all the delicious feasts I wish I could have if I were around people.
Yeah. Why was it important for May to experience food and in her family and in her culture?
I think, you know, the culture that I come from, food is a way of showing love. And for me, her parents have always loved her. They have always supported her. But one thing they did was they also praised her a lot for her chess achievements. And so in her mind, she began to equate her achievements with being loved. And she was afraid that if she stopped winning, if she stopped bringing home the medals and the trophies, her parents wouldn't love her as much. And, you know, as an adult, when I'm reading through my own story, I realize that that's not the case. Like, her parents would love her regardless. But when you're a child, you don't necessarily see that. And so I wanted to convey that, you know, with food, like, her parents have always wanted to give her the best. They've always been rooting for her. And in their minds, it was never about what she achieved. It was just about whether she loved doing it.
And I think you do such a great job of that, because so often as a high-achieving child, you are told that you're putting the pressure on yourself. Like, you're your toughest critic. You're a perfectionist. And those things might feel true to the adults around you. But I think in the book, you also map out these really subtle ways that the adults are saying things and celebrating things and encouraging things that do get internalized. Mm-hmm. And then in her peer group, failure has consequences too. It's not just coming from May. It's coming from everywhere. And May has to learn how to deal with it. I thought you did that really, really well.
Thank you. Yeah, I did want to show that, you know, even encouragement, it's so positive. Everyone has really positive intentions, but it could also just be perceived in the way that it was not intended to. I studied psychology in college, and so I did research at this kindergarten for developmental childhood psychology. And one of the first things that the teachers there, they taught me on day one was, when you are giving compliments to a child, don't praise them for the work that they created. Praise them for what they did to get there. So if they did this really nice drawing, don't say, oh, this is a beautiful drawing. Say something like, oh, I really like the way you did the shading here. And it's the same for a chess game. You know, instead of praising a child for, oh, I'm so proud of you, you came in first, you could say something like, I'm so proud of you, you applied this thing that your coach taught you last week. I'm so proud of you for fighting in the last game, even when you were down a piece, things like that.
Yeah. What does she lose? What does she learn by losing a chess game? It's so important. After you lose a match or a game, what happens next in chess?
What happens next in chess, ideally, you just try to look ahead. You try to look forward to the next game. You try to pick yourself up and tell yourself that you have another chance to prove yourself. But, you know, in the moment, it's really hard. I think with a chess game, it becomes such a silent battle sometimes. It's just you and a person sitting across from you. You get so immersed in it that it's hard to immediately snap yourself out of it. It's hard to immediately look ahead instead of dwelling on everything that you did wrong, everything that you could have done better. And then you just start beating yourself up about it. You get very harsh on yourself.
Yeah. May has a conversation with a soccer player and envies the fact that he can run around and burn off all that stress and energy when he's playing soccer. And you describe really well what it's like to have all that stress and anxiety and, you know, cortisol and have to sit still.
It is so hard because I also grew up playing soccer. I played chess up till middle school, and then I played soccer in high school. And there are actually so many similarities between soccer and chess. And I try to illustrate some of them in this book that, you know, at first, the two characters, they think that they come from very different backgrounds. They have nothing in common. And then as time goes by, they realize that they face the same pressures. They face the same expectations, albeit in different activities.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about the design of the book, because the illustrator and the book designer, the spot illustrations, all lead toward fun little finds for chess players.
Yeah, so I always say that, you know, ultimately this is not a book about chess. If you know nothing about chess, you can still read and enjoy this book. It is just a story about a girl who loves chess and wants to be able to pursue the activity that she loves. So if you do know chess, you'll be able to enjoy the little Easter eggs I dropped throughout the book. You'll be able to enjoy some of the fun little diagrams sprinkled throughout the story. If you know nothing about chess, you might be able to pick up some things just from reading this book as well.
Yeah. You also deal honestly with what boys in middle school say to each other about girls in competition and what girls overhear. Are these some of the same things that you overheard as a child?
Yes. So it was never a case of, you know, someone just coming right up to my face and saying, girls suck, girls can be as good at chess as boys. But it would just show itself in more subtle, insidious ways. For example, when a boy finds out that he's playing against me, I've heard them say things like, oh, thank God it's a girl. Like the assumption being that girls are just easier to beat. Or if a boy lost to me, I would hear his friends making fun of him, like, oh, how could you lose to a girl? Mm-hmm. And even today, I think there are different expectations placed on the two different genders. For instance, if you want to become a woman grandmaster, you have to achieve, like, let's say, 2,400 points. But if you want to become a grandmaster, you have to achieve 2,500 points. And so it's like being in school and a teacher telling you, if you're a girl, you can get an A just by getting 80 points. But if you're a boy, you can get an A by getting 90 points. And so boys are raised with the belief that they can achieve more, that they are capable of achieving more. Whereas girls think that, oh, like I have to be given like special accommodations because they don't think that I'm capable of doing it on my own. And that kind of thinking, it starts from when you're really young and then the kids internalize it.
Yeah. So I'm curious then, you go to Stanford and Silicon Valley and the tech world. You're not running from a male-dominated.
I'm not. You're so right.
What did you bring? What kind of memories did you bring to your adult work? Do you still struggle with them?
I think that I am more cognizant now of the very subtle ways in which, you know, sexism or any sort of bias can present itself. Again, it's not really the case of a male executive coming up to me and telling me that I'm not capable. It expresses itself in the small ways, like the female employee of the group being asked to take notes all the time, the female employees of the company being asked to organize happy hours and organize dinners, as though that is just something that is part of the women's domain. Mm-hmm. So I became a little bit more aware of things like that.
Did you hear when you're at schools here in Rapid City or schools across the country, really, as you visit classes, what are the kids telling you?
So I've heard similar sentiments from the kids, and I've realized that even though I wrote this book about what how I felt when I was playing chess, and that was over a decade ago, not much has changed. Because one thing that always surprises the kids when I tell them in school talks is that globally, out of all registered chess players, only 11% of them are girls and women. As of 2023, so maybe things have gotten better since then. But you know, 11%, that is probably around the same number that it was back when I was still playing chess. And I used to be heartened that chess has taken off online during the pandemic. I thought that, you know, with the Queen's Gambit, maybe it was breaking down some of the gender barriers. But what I heard was that as online chess became more popular, that was actually not doing anything positive for gender representation. Because online, when everyone is anonymous, people feel more comfortable saying hurtful things they wouldn't say in real life. And so female players were getting a lot of sexist comments. They were being told things like, oh, you must be a girl by the way you play. Like, you play so timidly, you're not aggressive enough. And then if everyone's exposure to chess now comes from online chess, and then that's your first exposure to chess, it's all these negative comments, they might just think to themselves, well, it's not worth sticking around to see if it gets better. Let me just save my mental energy and do something that's going to be more welcoming, where I don't have to fight every single day to prove that I deserve to be here.
Yeah. Your favorite piece is the bishop, like May? Or do you have a different favorite piece than May?
Oh, it changes all the time.
Does it?
It really does. Yeah.
What's so great about the bishop for May?
The bishop, it goes diagonally. It zooms across the entire board. So it's very straightforward. It's very direct. It's also quite aggressive. And I think that is May's playing style. She's pretty bold about it. Whereas, you know, the counterpart to the bishop is the knight. And the knight is sneaky. It kind of goes into the little corners. It squirrels away. So that just doesn't really fit May's personality.
Yeah. There's a moment, I don't think I'm giving anything away, when she is confronted for a photo shoot with a beautiful chessboard, which is not what she gets to play in chess club, because the pieces are all chipped and beat up and what have you. And she just has that moment where she realizes how beautiful the game is, how beautiful the boards can be, and how long people have been playing chess. Tell us a little bit about the history of this game and what makes it special and beautiful to you.
Yes, yeah, so chess is a game that I believe originated from India. It's one of the oldest games in human history, at least 1,500 years old. It was inspired by battle, and that's why you have pieces like the knight, the castle, the king, and queen. So every time someone says, you know, oh, chess seems really boring, it seems really slow, I'm like, this is a game that's inspired by battle. Like, there's nothing slow or boring about it. It is so action-packed, so exciting. And, you know, the sentiment that May felt, that was something that I experienced once, because I was so upset about a game. And then I think because of something my coach said, I realized that, oh, like, this is just one game. In many, many games I'll get to play throughout my career, this has been a game that's been around for 1,500 years. So many games have been lost. So many games have been won. This is just one out of many, many.
Do you travel with a chessboard?
I don't, just because everything is online now.
You can do it online.
In fact,
yeah.
There was this one time very recently when I was playing a game across a physical chessboard, and I wasn't used to seeing it in 3D. I stood up so I could look over the chessboard and get that online digital view.
Do you have a favorite board, though? Do you have something that you treasure?
It's actually this really, really tiny pocket set. Yeah. I think, because when I started going to competitions, my grandpa would come with me. My grandpa was the one who taught me the game. And then so in between rounds, as we were waiting for the next round to start, like, I'll play just like little games with him. The pieces are so tiny, like, I'm forever knocking them over. But it just reminds me of a time when, you know, I just started out playing chess. And I loved it so much that even when I was waiting for the next round to start, I was playing chess.
And you can even play it without a board or online by May with her friend, just call out.
Yeah.
That's confusing to me, but it was impressive to read.
Yeah.
What's next for you? You also write for adults, and you've written several adult novels. What are you working on next?
Yes. Yeah, so my first two novels are adult novels. This is my third novel, my first one for children. My next one is young adult historical fiction. So the first time I'm trying that age group and that genre. And it is set in 1949, San Francisco Chinatown, the oldest Chinatown in the United States. And it's about two rival gangs who must team up for a heist. And it was inspired by a trip that I took to the Mafia Museum in Las Vegas. So inspiration really just gets you anywhere.
What year think should we be looking for that?
I think it comes out next fall.
Next fall.
So I'm working on it.
Kylie Zhao, the book we've been talking about today is May the Best Player Win. She's headed back to some classrooms and then up to Spearfish tomorrow for the South Dakota Festival of Books. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break. More in the moment up next on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Black Hills Studios. The South Dakota Festival of Books is in Spearfish this weekend. And In the Moment broadcasts live from the festival at the Holiday Inn Spearfish Convention Center. We will talk about South Dakota weather and climate and how it intersects with the writings of Laura Ingalls Wilder. We'll also look at regenerative agriculture across America and how women are integral to rethinking the ag industry today. But today we are featuring authors who have written books for families and younger readers. Let's meet Brittany Richman. Richman is a former staffer for the White House. She is a presidential leadership scholar and co-founder of the American Moms blog. But it was a photograph in the Rapid City Airport of a spunky aviator with dark curls that captured Richman's attention as a children's author. The picture was of Nellie Zabel Wilhite, South Dakota's first licensed female pilot. A case of childhood measles had caused the loss of her hearing, and Richmond, who has her own deaf ear, felt an immediate connection. Her book is from Sleeping Bear Press, and it is called Dreams Take Flight. Brittany Richmond, welcome to The Moment. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Take us to the airport and that moment where most people might walk by a picture.
Yeah, well, sadly, I hate to say that I did walk by that picture many times. It was a friend who is a flight attendant who sent me a text one day and said, "Hey, have you ever stopped at the photo wall in the airport?" I was like, "Well, no, I'm usually in a hurry. I have three kids. I'm usually dragging them behind me, and we're in a rush." And she said, "Well, you need to look up this woman." And there was the picture of Nellie right there. And so I immediately got out my iPad and started researching her life. And I was like, wow. And I thought, like, what a shame that more people don't stop and look at those pictures, right? And she had such an incredible life, and I was actually shocked that nobody had written about her yet. So I was happy to be able to be the first one to do it.
And do you think, what was the reason? Because as you get into the archives, was there a dearth of information?
Yeah, well, I mean, she grew up in the early 20th century, so there's obviously things that we don't know about her, but luckily her letter collection is housed in Sioux Falls, and so I was able to access a lot of the letters that she had written to her father. So when she was a younger child, obviously like in the early 1900s, education wasn't easily accessible for someone who was hard of hearing or who was deaf, and so her father sent her away to the South Dakota School for the Deaf, which sometimes can seem a little bit cruel, but I think he didn't know what other option to have. Her mother had just passed away, and he knew she didn't have any options. She grew up in Box Elder. She didn't have any options there, so he sent her to the School for the Deaf, where she was able to get an education and to learn, and where I think a world was opened up to her that way.
And at the time, what did people think about hearing impaired people?
So there were definitely some stigmatisms, and you know, there sometimes still are. So her mother, before she passed away when Nellie was young, had started teaching her sign language. And when she got to the school, she thought, okay, everyone's just gonna sign and it's gonna be easy breezy. But they didn't want her to sign. They wanted her to learn to read lips because they thought if she was out in society, out in the world, signing, that would be a detriment to her. They wanted her to read lips. And so she grew up reading lips. She was really good at it. She even could speak. And obviously, as you know by listening to some of the clips we're going to listen to later, she was a little bit hard to understand, as sometimes people who are hard of hearing or deaf are, because they can't hear their own voice in their head the same way that we can. But she was so smart and so capable. Mm-hmm. And that's really the message I wanted kids to get from this book, is that disability isn't inability, that you can really set your dreams sky high as you want, and maybe you have to achieve them a different way than other people do, but it's still something that is doable and that we should just not give up on our dreams.
Yeah. In the Moment, producer Ari Youngman and I were listening to Nellie's voice through the oral history archives at the University of South Dakota at the Oral History Center, and the thing that struck us is how hard she had to work to be able to have that conversation. So we're going to play a little clip of that now. You'll hear the interviewer ask her a question, and she'll talk about when Charles Lindbergh flew over Rapid City, and she found out that that was him in a plane above her. Take a listen.
How did you get interested in flying, Nellie?
Well, it so happened that during my hay fever season, when I spent the time at High Sierra, South Dakota, that was in 1927 at this time, I was sitting at my desk by the window and writing, and all of a sudden this very heavy shadow crossed over my cabin. I couldn't imagine what it was. So I went out and looked, and there was Lindbergh flying over on his 1927 Western trip. He was on the way to Cheyenne from Rapid City, where he had landed that afternoon. This was in August. And I knew that it was Lindbergh because the next day I read the Rapid City Journal saying that Lindbergh had landed, and he had left about 3 o'clock, which was the time that I noticed the airplane flying over.
So she sees a shadow, she looks up, she knows it's Lindbergh, and she verifies it in the Rapid City Journal the next day because they say what time he flew over Rapid City. I hate to be all finding your roots, but what does it feel like to hear to hear that voice that you wrote about and are telling kids about today speak in 1977 about this just profound experience that she had?
I mean, if you think about, like, dreams that kids have now and people they look up to. I mean, Charles Lindbergh was a legend in aviation even then. He may be a little bit more controversial now, but back then he was just, he was it, right? So he was probably one of her heroes and who she really looked up to. And to see the shadow of his plane flying over her like that, like, what a memory to have. That's amazing.
You mentioned her father and their relationship, and he is the one that she writes to and says, I want to fly. He sends her part of his paycheck. Tell us a little bit about what you noticed in the letters that you found about this father-daughter relationship that they had.
Yeah, so it was a little bit complex in that they didn't live in the same home for most of her childhood. And so when she was at the South Dakota School for the Deaf, she was kind of, not adopted, but she was kind of taken on as a foster child by two of her teachers who just fell in love with her. And she would write home to her dad, and still very much a father-daughter relationship, and obviously she missed him so much, and you can hear that in her letters. You know, as a child being away from your only parent you have left, that's got to be really hard. It had to have been really hard for her. But he loved her, and he would do anything for her. Mm-hmm. And again, it might seem a little bit rough on the outset, thinking that he sent her away to this school, but he was doing it because he loved her, and he wanted her to have opportunities that he knew she couldn't have if she would have stayed in Box Elder at the time. And so when she started becoming interested in aviation, she was working at an airport near Sioux Falls, and she just saw a flyer for, like, flight lessons. And she was just amazed that, like, anybody could learn to fly. You know, like, what an ambition back in those days. And she luckily had people who believed in her because they saw her true potential just as her father had and encouraged her to do it. And yes, she had barriers, you know, that were different than other people who were hearing, full hearing have. But so when she told her father, like, I'm doing this, I need some money for it, he was all in. Like, he believed in her full heartedly. And, like, that's so awesome. Like, such a supportive parent.
Barriers, for example, her flight coach is in front of her in the plane and she is behind them, which you talk about in the book. Tell me a little bit about how they worked out some of the challenges, which is he can't just shout over his shoulder to tell her something.
Right.
How'd they figure it out?
Right, well, and obviously he could have shouted, but she wouldn't have heard, first of all. And second of all, she read lips. So he couldn't turn his face enough for her to see his lips. So they had other little cues, like if something was wrong. Obviously, flight instruments back then were much more primitive than they are now. But she could feel the engine's vibration through her feet. So if something was wrong or, like, sputtered, she would know. And she also had a little rope that she would tie on the side of her plane. Again, so if something was wrong, you know, if everything is going smoothly, it would just, you know, flutter in the wind like it should. But if something was wrong, it would stop and it would do different things. And so she would know. So she had different ways of figuring it out, as, you know, people who are either blind or hard of hearing do. They use their other senses to their full capacity, which is really amazing. So that's what she did to learn how to fly.
Was she able to work as a pilot then, or fly throughout her whole life?
So she didn't fly her whole life. She did work. She did some jobs for money. She did stunt pilot in some flight shows, and so that was kind of fun. But unfortunately, she didn't have the same opportunity that men did back then. It was still women, you know, let alone a deaf woman, weren't seen as being as capable as men. So she was paid far less for the jobs that she did. She would go around the state and she would make little homemade handkerchiefs with homemade parachutes. And people would say, hey, give this to the mayor of, you know, Sioux Falls. And she'd fly over where their city hall was and she'd drop these messages to them. And so she has a lot of fun stories like that. But again, she didn't get paid as much as men. Mm-hmm. I think at some point it didn't make sense for her to just keep doing it. She did it for a long time. She had the plane that her father, she named after her dad. Yeah. But she kind of had to retire from that a little bit early. But she was a founding member of the 99 Club started by Amelia Earhart, which, what an exciting era for, you know, an aviator to be alive and to know Amelia Earhart. She founded the chapter in South Dakota.
You do a lot of work helping families raise good citizens. And that seems to me, through with your twin sister, online and at, you know, speaking events, seems like a really important but also really hard time to be doing that work. Yeah. How do you approach that today?
Well, you know, I think so often as parents, if your parents or even grandparents of young kids, you don't want them to hear about all the ugliness of politics in today's world. But I think, but we can focus on the good things that's happening, the good part of politics, like the good things that come from the hard work that our legislators are doing. And I think we need to start there, even just locally with the school boards and with our city council, just teaching them how laws are made and that voting is the very bare minimum of what a citizen should be doing. The reason we started this blog in the first place was because after every election, we'd hear so many complaints from friends and people we knew online who were just so upset if their candidate of choice lost, but yet they weren't willing to do their part to help them win where they lived. And grassroots efforts, even in presidential campaigns, are everything. So if there's a candidate you believe in, it's so much more than just voting. It's going out and making phone calls or knocking on doors for them. And it's a lot easier now than it used to be. You know, there's a lot you can do electronically, you know, posting on social media. But again, I always say, like, face-to-face and talking to someone about politics is so much more beneficial than online. Online, it gets very ugly, as you know, really quickly. So it's good to expose our kids to the good things that happen in our nation.
So how young is, and what, you know, don't tell them the really hard stuff until they get older, but how young before they can get behind a candidate? Because all our candidates seem incredibly complicated as human beings. And if you are out stumping or putting in flyers for the presidential candidate of your choice, surely someone is going to say to your kids something horrible about that candidate. How do you bring your kids into an environment that's toxic, but do it in a healthy way?
Yeah, I mean, that's hard. I think maybe you start with something a little bit different. You start taking them to a school board meeting. I took my daughter was in kindergarten when I took her to her first school board meeting. And we just listened. It was a topic. I can't remember what it was about. But it was a topic I was interested in, and I wanted to see what was going to happen. And she happened to be with me. I'm like, let's go. So maybe it's not starting with all of that highly toxic, polarizing stuff. It's starting with things that are calmer in your own city. And obviously, local issues can get heated as well, but they're not usually quite to the extent that they are at the federal level just yet. So I would just say start smaller.
Yeah. And start local.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a South Dakota election bingo card, like you have a bingo card for the State of the Union?
You know, I need to do that. We, our readers on our blog are from all over. We just have a small portion from South Dakota. Uh-huh. So we haven't quite started that level yet, but that's a great idea.
That blog again is the American Moms blog, and you have another book about Disney, but not the Disney you're expecting.
No, so
Tell us about that.
So my very first book, it was published this last summer. It came out right before Dreams Take Flight did. It is about Lillian Disney, Walt Disney's wife, and it all just started on a trip to Disneyland with my family. I happened to walk by the partner statue where Walt is holding Mickey Mouse's hand right in front of the Cinderella castle. And I noticed that he had a wedding ring on. And it just made me stop for a second. And I thought, I've not even thought about Walt Disney being married. I just had never crossed my mind. So right then and there, I just on my phone, I looked up who was Walt Disney's wife. And I found out about Lillian. And she was a very private person. She did not want the spotlight. So I related to that. I don't need to be in the spotlight ever. I'm perfectly happy being behind the scenes. But she did a lot. She was a huge support for him. And he couldn't have done any of it without her. So it was fun to write her story, and she was, again, because she didn't do a lot of public interviews, it was really hard to dig up. I had to really search deep to get info on her.
All right, well, where are you going next on vacation? What's the next book from vacation going to be then?
Well, so my next book coming out, I have a couple coming out. One is another picture book. It's called Haunted by History. It's about Harry Truman moving into a haunted White House. So that's coming out. It got pushed back a little bit. The illustrator couldn't start on it as soon as we wanted. So that will be early 2027. And then I have a book for older kids, a middle grade nonfiction, about the history of bipartisanship in our country and how we wouldn't be a country at all without different people and different groups compromising and coming together.
All right. So, Brittany Richmond, thank you so much for taking time for public broadcasting today. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
We'll do some Badger Clark up next on listener-supported SDPB. You are listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Author Nancy Beau Flood describes Badger Clark's poetry as Shakespeare meets Walt Whitman during a cattle drive. And with insight like that, who better to write a new biography of South Dakota's first poet laureate, Badger Clark, for young readers? We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Black Hills Studios, and we are spending the whole hour with authors who have written books for families and children. This weekend, readers and writers convene in Spearfish for the South Dakota Festival of Books. Nancy Beau Flood has been a researcher, a counselor, a teacher, a parent, and a writer. Her work has taken her all over the world, and we are awfully pleased to have her here in the Black Hills to discuss her latest book, Badger Clark Poetry Wrangler. Welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and thanks to everyone here at the studio. You've been so welcoming. Thank you.
This was the book that just landed on our desks. Like, we knew it was coming, so I think it's safe to say it was, like, the most anticipated title, because we're like, where's Badger? Where's Badger? Is he here yet? Is he here yet? And so I was able to open, and I was so delighted with it from the cover to page one. And before we get to the main title page, even, there is a contemporary rodeo where Badger Clark's Cowboy Prayer is being read. Was that a book designer decision? Did you want that before the title page? Tell me a little bit about how that came about.
That was a wonderful surprise to me. It was a book designer decision, and they asked me about it. They were so thoughtful to say, what do you think? Do you mind if we take this part and put it before? And I thought, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Let's get right in there, into the story. And then, and so that's the way it was presented, and I think it's worked really well.
Yeah, showing people that, you know, people all over South Dakota, at least, and beyond, at rodeos, remember his work, even if they might not realize it's him. And you also do this wonderful thing with the town names of Tombstone and Deadwood to gently remind, and I hadn't thought about that as an adult in a long time, how distressing those town names might be for children.
Well, and I think also intriguing, like, who would name a town Tombstone or Deadwood? And I thought, oh, children will enjoy that and thinking about it. And it also was so reflective of where Badger was in his life, because another thing I thought is so important about how he shared his life and his feelings and his viewpoints is that he came back from Cuba it was a mess.
Yeah.
And he'd made some bad decisions. He'd gotten into trouble. He'd actually been thrown into prison. And he came back without any money. And most of all, that his heart was broken because his mother had just died of tuberculosis. His older brother that he loved had also died of tuberculosis. And the physician said, you know what? You're about to die from tuberculosis. But he didn't quit. And so to then go from Deadwood to Tombstone to find his life, it was a remarkable connection.
Why did you want to put those bad choices and those really difficult, hard things in a book for kids? Because you could have left that out and just talked about the joy of being a cowboy.
A good question. And it was something I had thought about hard, because part of my own background is as a counselor, child psychologist. And I think one of the myths that is kind of sold to children is the people that are heroes is like, bingo, you're a hero. And instead, no, heroes, all of us have to struggle through the disappointments and the rejections and the mistakes and get back up again, you know, just like a cowboy, get back up and get on that horse. And Badger did that, and I think to me that is so helpful to children to see you can fall down pretty hard and you can get back up.
Yeah. If you're going to write a book about Badger Clark and include his poetry, it really helps if the book itself is poetic. So here is a line from the book. Some evenings, instead of heading back to the ranch house, he slept on the open range, his saddle as his pillow, the earth as his bed. Here, Badger discovered something he had been searching for, a peaceful place where the moon's soft light bid him welcome, a place that felt like home, a place he included in his prayer.
Thank you.
This is beautifully written.
Well, beautiful. I want to say felt because I too fell in love with the Southwest, and uh, I The power of Badger's poetry is that he really gives to it, the reader, that you're right there with him. You're right there with him. And what a tremendous gift. So I wanted to share that with the readers, that this is how he felt. And one of the things I realized he was searching for was connection and home. He'd lost his home. He'd lost his connection with others, and he found it. And I think that that is an important part of his journey to share with readers.
Yeah. Most people who are from South Dakota think of Badger Hole as a place where he lived and worked and wrote. Are there places in the Southwest that also commemorate his time there, or is it pretty much centered around here? Do you know?
Yes, particularly in the Southwest, so in Colorado and in Arizona, because he went to Arizona to try to regain his health and to survive, to survive tuberculosis. And again, a remarkable part about Badger and the way young people can be so brave is he landed in Tombstone, and he needed a job, he needed a place to live. And he saw an ad and talked to the guy that owned a ranch, and he needed somebody to take care of the ranch while he was gone. And he said, "Badger, you know, can you do that?" "Yep, I can do that." And well, actually, he hadn't ridden a horse much, and he'd never taken care of cows, but he said yes, he could. And so he did it. He tried his best, but so Arizona also feels like they have a little bit of I don't want to call ownership, but a connection to Badger. And it also reflects, I was actually trying to initially write a book about cowboys and cowboy hats. And one remarkable thing for me is that the great respect that cowboys have for the land and for their animals that they're taking care of. So I'm trying to figure how to write about that, and I love rodeo. I love backyard rodeo, and my husband and I were living and working on the Navajo Nation for a number of years, and I go to all the rodeos, and you see those horses come in and the young kids riding them, and around they go, and all the families there, you know, where the grandmother's been braiding, and everybody's helping each other, but then all of a sudden there's this quiet. The horses are lined up, and I'm like, "Oh, whoa, what's going to happen?" And we all sing the Star Spangled Banner, and it's the first time the cowboy hat comes off, right? But then the second time in Arizona, when the cowboy hat comes off, it's for Badger's poem. And I heard that poem and just thought, wow, it's just so moving. We're all in tears. And who wrote that poem? And so that was the beginning of my quest to find out. Cowboy's Prayer.
And so often it's listed as anonymous. That's part of the story, is that he was bemused by the fact that maybe arguably his most popular poem was often unattributed to him, had become as if some secret person had just left it on the wind when he had, you know, worked so hard to make it the best it could be, and it did endure. What was his relationship with that?
He wrote the poem because his stepmother, whom he greatly loved, asked him to. And his first response was, I'm not a poet. But she said, "Please just write to me. What's it like where you are?" And he wrote that poem for his mother. He doesn't use the word stepmother, for his mother. And she found it so remarkable that she sent it into a magazine, one of the precursors to the Arizona, it instantly became so enjoyed by the readers that they wrote in and said, "We want more. We want more poems like that." Yeah. So that was because his mom asked him to.
A lesson for mothers.
Yes.
What to ask for. In the biographical material in the back of this book, you mentioned that Badger Clark also spoke out against war, against consumerism, against injustice. If he were here today, what are some of the things that he would really want us to be thinking about in poetry and just in our conversations, you know, privately?
Oh, thank you for that question, because he wrote all his life about those things. And his poem, "Read My American," is asking us to take care of the land, take care of this world. We are the guardians, not the consumers of it. And just saying, come on, everybody, do your part. It's so important that we're doing this for our children. He certainly wrote just very bravely about the Native Americans and as well as the blacks. He wrote in editorials here and in the 50s, which, you know, they were not popular, but he spoke, we owe them a lot. And so to honor everybody, that was another, thread throughout much of his poetry and his stories. He has written delightful and remarkable stories as well. He has a great sense of humor. But that his great respect for all things, we're all connected. The ground we walk on, the trees, the people, the rocks, the beauty of it, the beauty of everyone, and to respect everyone.
Yeah, and that is so a part of the book as well. The illustrations are just beautiful, and we should mention the illustrator, Gene Bowman. The book is called Poetry, Badger Clark, Poetry Wrangler. It's from South Dakota Historical Society Press. If you've not checked out the books from the South Dakota State Historical Society Press, man, do they have a good list. And I'm just delighted that you're able to be part of it. This is such a great book for adults and for kids, and to get out and spend time in nature looking around and thinking about being the guardian and not the consumer. I love that. What are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on a couple of projects. One is about murals, public art, and the importance of public art, like right across the street I was out photographing. And the way it's so democratic that we can put up, and also democratic in the sense of universal. You don't need words, you don't need to know the English language. You can see it and it will speak to you, and what is it speaking about? So the power of public art, the power of murals. And also, interesting to a connection of the previous author is that a young adult historical fiction that has to do with Vietnam, that has to do with having a father in prison. I counseled children that had parents in prison and was just so deeply touched by their commitment to each other. To make a family, even though you can only visit your dad once a month. And also the huge danger, because some of the children I counseled with, their parents died in prison. Mm. So it, I feel like an important awareness that needs to be, and also to be shared with kids who are in that position of having someone that's incarcerated.
Thank you for that. Important book. Nancy Bo Flood encourages us all to read anything and everything. You never know when you're going to need a good book. So thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so very much. And thank you to all the wonderful festival that's going on. Incredible. Yeah.
Meet us in Spearfish. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. Special thanks today to our studio audience in Rapid City. And thanks to the STPB staff here in the Black Hills. They always help us, and our crew feels so at home. Colton Nicholson has been our engineer today. We're going to take this whole shop up to Spearfish next. Plus, I want you to know Be Our Neighbor Day is tomorrow in Aberdeen at the Public Library. Inspired by Fred Rogers and Daniel Tiger, Be My Neighbor Day helps kids learn about being a caring neighbor. Families can make care packages for the community, sing songs with Daniel Tiger, and hang out with Science Steve for a demonstration. That event is free at the Public Library. It runs from 10 to noon local time in Aberdeen. From all of us here at SDPB, we thank you for listening.